2 years of him sending for Paul frequently to talk to him. Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, but because he wanted to grant a favor to the Jews, he left Paul, the Greek says, he left Paul bound. So Paul had freedom. He was in protective custody until Felix, Luke doesn't tell us here, but history tells us that at this point, Felix was recalled to Rome and he spent the rest of his life in disgrace in Rome. But before he left, in order to perhaps cater some favor from the Jews, he left Paul bound. We have to stop there because we'll pick up the story next week. We'll go back and look at some details. But remember, Jesus made a promise. He said, "You're going to Rome." Does this look anything like the path to Rome? Does it look like he's even getting a fair trial? Does it look like there's any purpose in these delays? I know Satan's tactics well enough because he tries it on me that when a promise is being delayed in its fulfillment, the lies flow like wine. And you'll start to doubt whether you ever heard from the Lord. Maybe I just imagined that. Maybe it really wasn't Jesus that came and stood near me, because this sure doesn't look anything like God's promises are coming true. So let's rewind back up to the top. There's a couple of rabbit trails in here, and there are some good nuggets. Even though a lot of it is narrative, if we open our hearts to it, I know there will be some great blessings in here for you. We had a great time last night talking about some of these things. Ananias, at this point in his life, the high priest Ananias was 80 years old. If you look on a map at where Caesarea Maritime is and look where Jerusalem is, it's just about exactly 60 miles northwest. But Jerusalem is over 1,000 feet in elevation and Caesarea Maritime is at sea level. So all of the years worth of erosion, centuries, eons worth of erosion, make that road. When we drove it on our bus, when we were headed back to the airport from Jerusalem, I don't know if you remember that topography, but it was like Bryce Canyon or the Badlands in, where are the Badlands? Wyoming, North Dakota. Ugly, ugly, torturous terrain. What would make an 80-year-old man travel 60 miles over torturous roads just to give false testimony about somebody? What could possibly? Hatred, pure and simple. And you look at that and you think, that's mind-boggling that somebody 80 years old would hate Paul enough to make that kind of a life-threatening trip just to tell lies about him in front of the Roman governor. I'll tell you what's even more pathetic is that that hatred was stronger than the Christian love that the church in Jerusalem had for Paul, because none of them made the trip to stand by his side. In the church in Jerusalem, at this point in its history, was not a very bright light. Which is always what happens when the church is worried about being people pleasers. Your light doesn't burn very brightly. So here's Ananias, 80 years old, traveling 60 miles just to tell lies. Takes a lawyer with him. Don't get me going on lawyers. We used to have a couple of lawyers in our church. They moved away. They were good guys, but it was always fun when I talked about lawyers and they were here, because they would be the first to roll their eyes because they know the reputation that their vocation has in the world. So Tertullus, the lawyer, comes and he opens with flattery, and I've often wondered, you know, were there people running for the vomitorium, you know, during this speech, because there was not one person in the entire room believed anything that this lawyer said, except Felix. Felix was one of those nasty people that are totally delusional. In fact, history tells us that when Rome fired him and brought him back, his feelings were hurt. He was clueless about how people hated him. So the flattery, apparently these guys knew him well enough to know, hey, maybe flattery will give us a little bit of an advantage. The problem was, Roman law was based on fear. And I suppose, in one respect, there's something to be said for that. You know, justice, if people were afraid of doing something wrong, and don't get me going on our justice system, because people aren't afraid of being punished for what goes wrong, and so it undermines the whole justice system. But in Rome, they were afraid. And that's why Paul is the hot potato before Felix, because Lysias is afraid to make any kind of a decision because Paul's a Roman citizen, so whoop, 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 you know, he passes the hot potato up to Felix, and then Felix passes it on to Festus, and then Festus passes it on to Agrippa, which we'll look at next week. If you wanted any kind of a chance, if you had any kind of a chance to get your way with Roman justice, you had to follow their rules. And their rules were you had to have at least two witnesses. Ananias didn't have to come. All he would have had to do was send a couple of people that would make false testimony. Remember they did that with Jesus? When they brought Jesus before the Sanhedrin and they accused him, but they couldn't kill him and they wanted to kill him, so they sent him to the Romans, but they had to send people who were willing to lie in their testimony, or the Romans wouldn't even hear the case. And that's basically what's happening to Paul. So he makes the charges. We found this man to be a troublemaker. And Paul, when he answers the charges, said, look, trouble does seem to happen wherever I go, but I'm not the one causing it. He said he stirs up riots among the Jews all over the world. Well, that was technically not true. It was the Jews all over the world that hated him that were starting the riots. Fuzzy math going on there for, you know, trying to bring accusation against Paul. We found him to be a troublemaker, stirring up riots among the Jews all over the world. He's a ringleader of the Nazarene sect. The word sect appears twice here, over in verse 14. And here, I wasn't exactly sure what it meant, so I looked it up in my Greek dictionary, and it's the word we get heresy from. It's the word for somebody who has invented their own theology, who's invented their own belief system, contrary to orthodoxy. So that's what Christianity was called by these people, a Nazarene sect. By the way, this is the only place in the entire Bible where Christians are called Nazarenes. The only place. It was not a complimentary term. Actually, the word Christian, which was coined in Antioch a few chapters ago, was not a complimentary term either. Remember when, and nobody told me last night, and I should have looked it up today. Remember when one of the disciples was called, I'm thinking Philip and Andrew, one of them called the other one and said, you got to come see, we think that Messiah is here. And go figure, it turns out he's a carpenter from Nazareth, a carpenter's son from Nazareth. And remember what the disciples said? Can anything good come out of Nazareth? That wasn't just his prejudicial opinion. That was a common idiom. It was a hick town that nothing good ever came out of. So when they called these people Nazarenes, it was a derogatory term. Now here's my first rabbit trail. Why was Jesus born in Nazareth? Why wasn't he born in Rome? Wouldn't you think if you were God, the King of the universe, and you were about to send your son to represent you in the world, that you would want him to be raised in the halls of power and go to the very best schools and be surrounded by influential people? Wouldn't you think? Isn't that the way we do it in our culture? I mean, the press is going to check later when you're running for office, you know, where did he come from? Why did God go to a young woman in a town that had a bad reputation as being a hick town that nothing good ever came out of? You know, another town associated with Jesus that had the same reputation was Bethlehem. Nobody wrote songs about it back then. It was just a nothing of a town. Why do you suppose that God picked those places for his son to be raised? Gil Irwin has wonderful things to say about it in the Jesus style, but he boils it down to one word. The word is approachability. The angel, when he spoke to Mary and Joseph and told them about the child that she was about to have and what they were to name him, remember, he said, you're to call him Yeshua, Jesus, but he will be called, his nickname, so to speak, will be what? Emmanuel, which means God is with us. God was sending a very clear message in the whole way that Jesus presented himself, where he was born. He came from out of nowhere. In fact, all the prophecies about him made a big deal about that. He'll spring up out of nowhere. And God was sending a message to the whole world. I want to be close to you. I am removing every barrier. I am not going to present myself to you through the halls of power. And approachability was the hallmark of Jesus' whole presentation. Jesus said, you want to know what God's like? Watch me. Where he was born, the way that he lived made him very unthreatening to the people that he came to rescue. So the church, the followers of Jesus, took these derogatory terms like Christian, which meant little Christ. Oh, you guys, you're so silly. You just think you're little Christs. And they thought, yeah, that's cool. It's like back in the late 60s when they called us Jesus freaks. And we didn't care as long as it had Jesus' name in it. We sort of wore it like a badge of honor. This is the only place they were called Nazarenes, and that was used as a sort of a derogatory term, just like the term Christian was a derogatory term. They called themselves followers of the way. In fact, that's what they called the Christian life. They didn't call it Christianity. They called it the way. And you know where that comes from, obviously, right? Where, remember when Jesus said, I'm going to the Father, and I'm going someplace you can't come right away, but I do want you to be with me? And remember the disciples said, well, wait a minute. If you want us to be with you, we don't know how to get there. How are we supposed to know how to get to your Father's house where you're going? He says, I'm the way. I'm the truth. I'm the life. Nobody comes to the Father except through me. I'm the way. And that was, they picked up on that, and that's what they called themselves. So that's my little rabbit trail about the Nazarene heresy, as they labeled it. Verse 6, he even tried to desecrate the temple, punishable by death under Jewish law. If they'd just have been allowed to carry out the death penalty, which the Romans wouldn't let them. Do you know what desecrating the temple was? Kind of shocking, actually. It's not dancing naked on the altar or smoking a joint or something, you know, in the presence of the high priest. Desecrating the temple meant you brought a Gentile into the part of the temple precincts that were only where only Jews were allowed. And they could kill you for that. Can you imagine that kind of prejudice in God's name? It would be like if you wanted to invite your cousin, who was an unbeliever, to come to church, and the usher met you and said, well, sorry, you can stand in the parking lot, but if you bring him inside the building, we kill you. What kind of a message does that send out about God? Now, technically, Paul didn't bring a Gentile into the temple precincts, and that's what he says later on in his defense. He says, I was alone. There was nobody with me. There wasn't a crowd with me. If you can remember last week, why did Paul go to the temple and do that whole hokey-pokey stuff anyway? He did it because the church asked him to. They said, would you mind? There are people that don't think you're very Jewish. Would you mind, just to take the heat off of us, would you mind, sort of like your Catholic relatives when you went home for Christmas, saying, would you just mind going to Mass and lighting a few candles? It'll just make Aunt Frieda happy, and she'll get off our case that, you know, you've gone over to the other side. It was that kind of a deal. So he only went to the temple and did the stuff that he did there to please the church. And now that he's in trouble for it, where's the church? Not one single person came and stood in his defense. It was a crime punishable by death to even try to defile the temple, but he wasn't guilty of that either. So verses 8 and 9, you know, everybody agrees, yeah, this is the truth, this is the truth. None of it was true. Verse 7, which I didn't read because it's not in most of the oldest manuscripts, but verse 7, I'll read it to you, it's in my footnotes, says, but the commander Lysias came and with the use of much force snatched him from our hands and ordered his accusers to come before you. So sandwiched in this accusation is verse 7, but the rule of biblical interpretation is if something doesn't appear in the oldest manuscripts that we have, it's called into question. It could still be genuine, verse 7. It does sound, I mean, it was true, and it does sort of sound like something that might be said, but it just wasn't in the oldest manuscripts that we have, and that's why I didn't read it. If you care about such things, it doesn't really add to the plot at all. So verse 10, when the governor motioned for Paul to speak, and Paul's searching his brain for something that he could say that's nice about Felix without lying. I do admire him for that. I admire that anybody that's willing to speak the truth and not resort to flattery. It's one of the reasons I hate election years. It's just that whole bogus, sugary sweet, I'll tell you you're wonderful if you'll tell me I'm wonderful, and nobody means it. I love that Paul just told the truth. He wasn't going to try to butter up Felix and resort to flattery. It sounds like Jesus, doesn't it? Jesus wasn't disrespectful when he was dragged into the kangaroo court. But he did tell him the truth. He didn't do it with hostility, but the thing you could always count on with Jesus is he was always going to tell you the truth. If the truth was going to hurt your feelings, he'd tell you anyway if you needed to hear the truth. He would say it in love, but he never resorted to flattery. He still doesn't. If you're being flattered, you might want to take a good whiff and see if you smell brimstone, because God doesn't do that. He'll tell you the truth. If you stink, he'll tell you you stink. He'll tell you that you stink and he loves you. And he'll tell you, get over here, let's hose you down. But he isn't going to tell you that you smell fine if you stink. He just won't do it. So anyway, that's another little, not really a rabbit trail, but I just love that Paul didn't resort to flattery. He just told the truth and said, yeah, you've been here for a while as governor. That's the nicest thing I can think of to say about you. The only real truthful, nice thing he could say. And he says, verse 11, you can easily verify, it was only 12 days ago all this happened. All you got to do is send somebody down there, and everything I'm about to tell you in my defense can be easily verified. I found verse 12 poignant. It's another little rabbit trail, I warn you. My accusers did not find me arguing with anyone at the temple. Can we say the same thing? Aren't church people famous for arguing?